From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Vermont poet Angela Patton. Born and raised in Dublin, Ireland, she now lives in Burlington, where she is a senior lecturer at the University of Vermont English Department. This year, Kelsey Books published Angela Patton's new collection, The Oriole and the Oven Bird. In our interview from the archives, we discuss Angela Patton's In Praise of Usefulness, which concerns thoughts of Ireland, the country that engendered the author's love of language and literature, and America, the country that fostered her development as a woman and a poet. I began by asking Angela to talk about poetry as memoir and how the forms differ in expressing a life. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
So many of my poems are memoir-like. They're stories, and I grew up on stories.
Right.
And so when I started writing poetry, I drew on all of those stories. And I think there is a different impulse. I've always wanted to write prose mm-hmm. as well. And so it was a great achievement for me to have written that memoir. But I realized that much of the same material has appeared in poems. I think there's a different focus on language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm teaching class at the moment, two sections of Intro to Creative Writing and two sections of the Personal Essay at UVM. And so I talk a lot with the students about the differences and similarities between memoir-like poems and creative nonfiction. And of course there's overlap, but the emphasis for me is that creative nonfiction isn't journalism. We don't go to it for just the facts, although mm-hmm. there may be facts involved. And that fine line between what's true and what are your memories. So it's a very interesting discussion. But of course, the material that I draw on a lot is my upbringing, the stories I grew up with, my parents and their stories, and the way they talked. And I think that material shows up in everything I write.
Sure.
But in writing poetry, I think there's a focus on compression and on, line breaks, the shape of the poem on the page, the impact. And also, even though I love to read prose out loud, that reading aloud with poetry mm-hmm. is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, of course, overall, it's all about voice, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction or poetry. But there's a difference. I think there's a difference in the way I think about images and especially visual images, but also sound.
Right.
It's a big subject, in other words.
So if you're going to refer to an image in poetry, do you try to find language that sounds like that image looks? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I tend to be very audio.
Yeah.
But of course, visual imagery is really important. But again, what I tell myself and the students is that it's about sensory images,
mm-hmm.
All the senses,
mm-hmm.
and not just the
not
visual.
Just the look, sure.
Yeah,
right,
and not
right.
just the sound. But I mean, poetry, another thing I was talking with a student about yesterday was anybody can write poetry. Anybody can write bad poetry,
right,
but
right.
writing a good poem is difficult, and it's where all of those things come together that you have a poem,
yeah.
a really good poem, where sound and visual imagery and attention to language and, of course, the impact, the subject matter, too. It's very difficult, but you know it when you meet it.
Right, right.
And, one student was saying yesterday, well, the beginning of the course seemed so easy because, after all,
it's
writing
just poetry.
Poems is easy.
Just have to rhyme,
which
right?
I don't agree with. But poetry, I think, is a difficult art, and unfortunately, most people, I don't think, recognize what a difficult art it is.
Yeah.
It seems easy. It seems like something you just tossed off, but of course it's not.
Right. Because people misconstrue short for easy.
Yes, exactly.
Right? It's a shorter
yeah.
form.
And
it must
concise
have been easier.
For
right.
easy. Yeah.
Right.
But at the same time, I suppose, with memoir, with nonfiction, I'm thinking more in terms of telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
You don't quite have that same focus with poetry.
I wonder if I can ask you to read one of the poems.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to.
Well, I'm going to ask you to read a bunch of the poems. Yes. So on page 3, Tabula Rasa.
Oh, yes. And actually, that came out of a poem, if you don't mind me talking about it.
No, please. That's fine.
I was in Dublin with my husband, Daniel, who's also a poet, and he's a great one for poetry prompts. As teachers, we always think about prompts. And I said, what shall I write about? Give me a prompt. And he said, write about something that happened to you, but that you can't remember. In other words, write about something that happened before you were born. And we happened to be walking past the church where I was christened in Dublin.
Oh, interesting.
And so that's where this poem came from.
Wonderful.
Tabula Rasa. I was christened in Westland Row Church, next door to the railway station, so I've always been a bit of a traveler. Add to that being born on a Thursday, which meant I'd have far to go. The church was a handy few streets from where I was born to expedite procurement of eternal life insurance. With influenza and other frigaries on the loose, an infant might well end up on the wrong bus and go wandering in limbo like a foreigner. The marble holy water font was massive enough to bathe or drown a baby, but my godmother held me tightly in voluminous layers of lace and cotton. I peeped out from under my christening shawl at the gold and white plaster faces looking down at me from the ceiling. Were they cherubs or little children who had gone before me up to heaven? The priest arrived like a bride in white vestments to cast out my sins, although gluttony was the only one I'd had any chance to commit in the 7 short days of my life. Outside, the grey stone structures of the city came to life. Thousands of tweed caps moved among shadowed alleyways as coal smoke belched from duct, pipe, and shaft. Hucksters hawked their meager harvest as corner boys keened the mangled names of newspapers. They called me Angela because the Angelus bell was ringing, and Mary for the mother of sorrows who was to become my longtime traveling companion. I roared when they rained cold water on my head, then slept amid the liturgical lullaby of prayers and the redolent aroma of incense. That was a somber place, full of statues of the crucified Christ laid out in his mother's arms like a broken mirror. I was given martyred saints for nursery mates, medals and holy pictures for protection, blood and thorns for my dreams.
Mm. Thank you. You know, I had a question about this, but hearing you read it out loud, it's like you say, you know, hear a poem read out loud and you're going to have so much more appreciation for
Indeed.
It.
Indeed.
My original question was about the line, the marble holy water font was massive enough to bathe or drown a baby. And I loved that line, and I was going to ask you, why is this kind of wry contradiction pleasing when we read? And, it, you know, it's funny, but there's a hint of tragedy. There's also a hint of truth, because family
yes.
is so important, and of course infant mortality was being talked about, as well as this is a christening. Anyway,
right.
that line I was going to ask you about. Now I have other lines and
oh, indeed.
language. But anyway, if we could start there.
Certainly. About the massive holy water font?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, part of it was that I went into the cathedral and looked around. And of course, I was imagining what it was like at the time, but it's very much the same big stone cathedral as it was then, and very similar to the churches I attended as a kid.
And it wasn't the church you had attended, other than being christened there?
Right,
did you not?
Right. Mm. But a similar kind of stone church that I went to all the time. And so I suppose it's an ironic voice, because yeah. I grew up in such a Catholic world, but of course I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, and yet I hope with age that I've learned to be a little bit more humorous and compassionate about all of that, rather than the raging, angry teenager I was, where I was just scathing about all things religious,
right,
you know.
Right.
But I loved my godmother, and, you know, it's such a wonderful, comical, colorful world,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. The world of the
of
Catholic
that
Church
world,
and
of my childhood,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So But going into the cathedral itself and being there was a wonderful experience.
Right, right.
But again, it was the whole notion, the whole Catholic notion, that you had to baptize children very quickly for fear they would die, but also, God forbid, they wouldn't go to heaven. You know, and then now, of course, right. limbo is gone. So where are those infants?
I think they've all been let up.
Right. Yeah.
They've all been let in.
But not in my day, they wouldn't have been.
You know? No, right.
Of course, they couldn't go to hell either. So
that was actually limbo. Another sort of funny, tragic line, which is like they're taking a bus to limbo.
Oh, know? Yes.
That was a
yes,
good one, too.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm being very ironic, but who would not be? You know?
It also has the voice of the child who was told these things.
Yes, that's
right?
it.
There's a little bit of that, too.
Yeah, I was steeped in all of that.
I'm sure.
And we had to learn the catechism by rote. And I happen to have a very good memory for things like that.
Oh.
So, I can recite those prayers and sins and all the rest of
right,
it.
Right, right, right. Well, so the other thing that I was just going to mention, having heard you read this one, and I'm sure it'll come up in other ones, but, you know, I don't see you as a formalist.
Right.
In most of your poetry, I wouldn't say that you're following a form that I recognize necessarily, but hearing you read that aloud, of course, I'm noticing all of this interlinked language, like meager and mangled and crucified Christ and mother and mirror. And, that's not necessarily formalism, but it is just sort of an attention to the language and
what
we'll pick up. Common threads.
And, yes.
Yeah.
Well, again, I suppose I come from, if you could call it, that school of poetry where I don't write formal poems, and I don't necessarily rhyme, but what I am concerned with is, internal rhyme, simile, imagery, all of those other devices that exist in poetry, apart from the more old-fashioned formal poems that rhymed or were in stanzas or meter. I tend to emphasize those other devices in poetry instead. Alliteration.
Right.
Right.
And I just
sound.
I loved outside the gray stone structures of the city came to life. Thousands of tweed caps moved among shadowed alleyways as coal smoke belched from duct, pipe, and shaft. Hucksters hawked their meager harvest as corner boys keened the mangled names of newspapers. Beautiful.
Oh,
and I've just
you.
Messed up the line breaks completely there.
Oh, no, that's fine. And the line breaks, of course, again, another device in poetry is the line breaks are only, they only work on a visual level.
Mm-hmm.
But that's important, too, because poetry operates on a visual level as well as an audio level. We look at the poem and then we listen to it and we have a different experience.
So, and now I didn't notice this just now, but when you read, how much of a nod do you give to each line break? Do you
very
not
little,
tend to?
Very
yeah.
little.
Yeah, okay.
Because you would end up with a rather sing-song effect, I think.
Right.
And, I love many rhyming poems. Many of my favorite poems are rhyming poems. But I think it's a very, very difficult thing to do well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, without it turning into the kind of limerick that's,
yeah, exactly.
that's fun. But that's,
or nursery rhyme. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
right. How would you like to read Making Tea for My Father on page 8? Is that okay?
Love to. Making Tea for My Father. Bring the water to a rolling boil. There's nothing worse than lukewarm tea. Take down the metal pot from the shelf, the one over the gas stove. It has a few dents, but you can't beat it for flavor. You can throw out those fancy earthenware jobs. I wouldn't give you thanks for them. Open the tea caddy and have a good long sniff. Since it's only meself and yourself, measure out a heaping spoonful each and one for the pot. Don't stint on the tea. That's the sign of a man so mean he wouldn't spit on you if you were on fire. Pour on the water and leave it stew on the gas for a good 10 minutes. A nice drop of milk and 2 spoons of sugar for me, if you please. You'll find a bit of sweet cake in the tin. Now that will put the red neck on you and a bit of hair in your chest, and no mistake.
Thank you so much. I love that poem. this is his voice, I'm thinking.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about voice in poetry. I don't necessarily think about voice in poetry all the time, but this one was so clear.
Yes.
So clearly this man's voice and your father's voice. So, yeah, can we just talk
about that? Well, I'm fascinated by voices and accents, too. And I grew up in Dublin with my mother's family, but my father came from County Meath. And even though he moved to Dublin when he was 16, he never lost his Meath accent, which was far more lilting than the Dublin accents around us. And he had funny ways of talking. He used certain words, but he also used similes all the time, even though he wouldn't have known what a simile was. But there were very rural similes. And, of course, tea. My parents didn't drink alcohol at all. They were pioneers. The Pioneer Total Abstinence Association was started in the 1930s to counteract the terrible alcoholism in Ireland. It was started by a priest called Father Matthew. And it, you know, it was... We were really pushed into it as Catholics. You know, you had to take the pledge to abstain from alcoholic drink when you made your confirmation at age 10. And it was supposed to last until you were 21. But of course, the drinking age was 18. So, you know, most people didn't continue it. But my parents were very sincere Catholics, and they wore a little pioneer pin in their collars to show that they didn't drink. And although my father spent much of his life in pubs playing Irish music, but he never had anything more than an orange crush, you know.
Oh, wow.
So I admired them for that, because they were never disapproving of other people who drank, you know. They never complained about it, but it was important to them. So tea was the drink. And in with my aunts and uncles too, I never saw anybody drinking. It was tea, morning, noon, and night.
Interesting.
But of course, I could never drink the tea that my father brewed now, you know. Oh, my God, it was really strong.
Yeah.
And he equated weak tea, as I said in the poem, with a weak person, and a poor fire, too, now, with a weak person.
It's funny, the instructions for making tea include a heaping spoonful each and one for the pot. And
yes.
It's funny because
it's
my
recipe.
Right, and my mother-in-law does the same thing with coffee.
Oh, there you
one
go.
One for the pot.
Yeah.
Plus
see, we didn't grow up with coffee at all.
Oh, isn't that funny?
Coffee was used for flavoring only.
Yeah.
But one for the pot, yes. In fact, I have a couple of old cookbooks of my mother's that I love, and there's a recipe for tea in the front, you know, serious recipe. But again, there's another little distinction here that you might not pick up. English people traditionally drink tea with lemon.
Oh.
Irish people drink tea in a mug with milk and sugar, you know.
Okay.
So it's almost an Irish-English dichotomy.
Funny. That's how my father drank his tea. I never thought about it being an Irish thing.
Well, you see, in my world it was, you know. Mm. And it was also working class.
Right. Well, I mean, we're very, my family's very Irish.
There you go.
And so he must have gotten that from his parents, who got it from Ireland.
Right.
That's
so exactly.
Funny.
But again, there was a kind of distinction, whether real or implied, between sort of, you know, more British-leaning people, Irish people, but with British sentiments, who might drink their tea from China cups and
have
with
a lemon. And
but
no sugar.
But not in our house. Well, maybe sugar, but perhaps lump sugar, at least when I was a kid, you know, delicate, you know.
Right.
But again, it was, in my mind as a child anyway, that separated the real Irish people from the sort of Shoneens or West Britons or, you know, English-leaning types.
Right.
So there's a whole other cultural backdrop here to making tea.
So I'm just thinking you should do a whole collection of poems about making tea.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Because there's also the Russians who suck their tea through a sugar.
Yeah, and also coffee.
Tea.
I think Turkish coffee, too. But there you are. Coffee is a whole other thing.
Right.
But tea,
different
yes.
collection.
Yeah.
That's
so,
awesome.
You know, it's a, and then there's all the different types of tea, you know. Barry's tea is like the proletariat tea.
Oh, wow.
But Lapsang Souchong, my parents never heard of it. In fact, I think I grew up thinking tea grew on the slopes of Dublin somewhere, you know.
Oh, that's funny.
And Jesus was born in a stable in Dublin, too, for that matter, you know.
You have a poem, and I remember when I went to your launch and you read this poem. I love this poem. This poem is perfect. Mea culpa? Would you mind reading Mea culpa?
Of course.
I never knew this was an Irish thing. It's a page 13.
Page 13. Okay. Mea culpa. This poem has an epigraph by Woody Allen. My only regret is that I wasn't born somebody else. Sorry I'm late, you whisper as you slip into the room with your breath in your fist. Sorry, sorry, I'm sorry, you mumble as you step over knees, ankles, shopping bags to reach your seat. The Irish are forever saying sorry. Sorry, we say, when some stranger bumps into us on the street, sends our parcels flying. He's a sorry-looking article, we say, of the wet dog, drunken neighbor, tight-lipped civil servant. For all the sins of my past life and those I haven't yet committed, I am truly and irrefutably sorry. Sorry to interrupt, sorry to have to tell you, sorry for your troubles, trials, and tribulations, sorry for living. Stop apologizing, your sister-in-law keeps telling you, not realizing that self-deprecation is your Siamese twin, and not even surgery could separate you now. Say you're sorry, we tell our children when we catch them acting the maggot, or I'll give you something to be sorry about.
Thank you. Loved that. I have to say, this was not set up. I apologized for being late I arrived at your door today. I do this all the time.
Yeah, and in the old days when people wrote letters, you were never supposed to begin with an apology, but of course everyone does. I'm sorry I haven't written before.
Right.
And haven't been in touch.
I wondered if this has tilted into emails, emails the day after apologies behavior at the party last night.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Though in my family's case, it's usually, I'm sorry I kept you on the phone so long, followed by a long email reiterating everything that was said on the phone.
So funny. Okay, I just
Of course, I have to admit that in Ireland, everyone says sorry, and it really means excuse me. Mm. Sorry when you bump into someone. But you say sorry when they bump into you, too. So it's one of those things.
And it probably is an outgrowth of another kind of sorry that they are in the habit of always.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, that's fun. I wanted to ask you, before we read another one, about the church as inspiration. And we talked a little bit about this around the tabula rasa.
Yes.
But, you know, you said that when you were a teenager, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have expected yourself to be thinking, maybe even with a certain fond memory of the church. I don't know, I'm putting words in your mouth. But
no, absolutely, you're right.
But can we just talk about that? And maybe even a larger subject, which would be that which is difficult becoming that which inspires us.
Yes, indeed. There's a real theme there, and it's a big theme to explore. And I feel as if I touch on it here and there. But of course, I think of my life, and I have a feeling this is true of a lot of people, that we work in a big circle, back to where we started. Mm. And for me, those circles operate in different ways. I think I was a kid who wanted to be creative, who had kind of leanings towards being artistic, but I was never able to do it, either because I had no clue how to make it happen, or because, as I think I mentioned in my memoir, my parents were working class people, and they said, that's not for people like us. Mm-hmm. No. But actually, it took me 30 years to get back to actually having a creative life, somehow or another, fumbling along to get back to where I began. Mm-hmm. And, lots of people have said, all three-year-olds are geniuses. It's how to remain a genius that's the problem. You know, all three-year-olds are creative. But we lose that as we get older.
Right.
And we all know when kids become teenagers, you know, sometimes the creativity they showed early on gets educated out of them. And but I'm not just talking about creativity. It may be a lot of other things that are really important to us.
Right.
And I was a very foolish, rebellious young woman. But my father was also quite authoritarian. And my aunts and uncles were not like that necessarily. So I have cousins in Ireland who grew up the street from us and are still in Ireland, still Catholics, didn't go through that same kind of fracture that I did. Mm. And my brothers and sisters and I have always asked ourselves why that is. What was different about them and us? And I think some of it was temperament, but also my father was much stricter than their parents. And so in a way...
And that's interesting. That almost backfired.
Yeah. He pushed us away. He loved us and he wanted to keep us close, but he pushed us away. Mm. And I was very rebellious. So I had to go a long way or do a big circle until I could come back perhaps to where I started with a different perspective.
Right, yeah.
Of course, as I said, I'm not a practicing Catholic and have not religious, and still angry at religion. I'm still scathing about religion in general. And yet, I think I understand the impulse towards it
sure.
a little more. And also the language I grew up with, I couldn't help but begin to appreciate how beautiful it is, how rich. Mm. So it seems rather, what's the word I'm looking for? Materialistic. To leave behind the faith, but take the language and use it, you know, use it to my own ends. But I do love the language and appreciate it. In fact, I was kidding around with my son when he came to visit a week or so ago, reciting the Litany of the Blessed Virgin, which I have at least half of still in my mind and could probably find the rest if I worked on
wow.
it. But it's beautiful language.
Start?
Well, it was a call and response.
Oh, okay.
And so we would say it after the rosary. And my father would give it out and we would respond. And the bits I remember are, there are all these terms of endearment for the Blessed Virgin. Tower of ivory, house of gold, Ark of the Covenant, refuge of sinners, comfortress of the afflicted.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
Star of the sea. They go on and on.
Right.
And it's wonderful language. But it was boring when we were kids. It was a prayer we had to say.
It was rote. It was memorized.
It was rote.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that only later I began to look at that.
Yeah.
But much the same Daniel would say about his upbringing as a Baptist child who grew up with the King James Bible. And that's become the basis of his poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit, for me, not just as a lapsed or collapsed Catholic, but also as just an Irish person, I don't have a lot of respect for religion, but I do love the language.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that occurs to me, and I was going to ask you to read this poem on page 14, Sisters. You mentioned how limbo is gone now.
Yeah.
And this poem has to do with a change of language within the practice and the church and the roles that people have in the church. And it just makes me think about how completely set in stone everything is until it's not.
Yes.
You know, which I think is part of what makes people furious with it. You know?
Right.
You're told that this is how it is, this is how it is, this is how it is, and then it changes, and then it's like, well, now this is how it is.
Yes.
Right?
Which I can never quite understand. I mean, the Catholic Church has changed drastically since I was a child.
Right.
And so, of course, any currently practicing Catholic would have a fit at some of these things. But I don't understand how you can suddenly change the rules midstream.
Well, particularly when you were so adamant about them.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. How is it not a sin now? How is it? How is St. Christopher, Mr. Christopher? You know, I just don't get it.
Right, right. So if you don't mind reading Sisters, I would love that.
Just one little footnote here. I mentioned Mother Patrick. When I was home in Ireland a couple of years ago, to my horror, I discovered Mother Patrick is still around. And my old school chums know her and think she's lovely. So I'm mortified that I put her in here in such a negative way. But there you are. Sisters. We were supposed to call them mother, those consecrated brides of Christ, who wore virginity like a virtue, profession rings on their wedding fingers, making us wonder what they thought of our own mothers, safe at home, presumably enjoying carefree, sinful lives, although my mother seemed as holy and her life anything but free. I liked Mother Dolores best, her country accent and her kindness, the shadow of a mustache on her upper lip. She said that what we didn't know would fill libraries, and I could picture shelves upon shelves of dusty dictionaries documenting my abysmal ignorance that stretched toward a distant vanishing point. Mother Patrick was tiny, furious, a hummingbird in massive headdress who hurled herself at us, dagger beak disclosing mismatched shoes, our shortened gym slips, lost berets. Mother Stephen was the quiet one, save for the rattle of the rosary beads against her stiff blue tunic, her bashfulness betrayed by the pink flushed skin against her white bandeau. One autumn we returned to school to learn the order's headquarters in Cluny had handed down an edict. No more enormous coifs and coronets, and no more mothers. Instead, we were to call these shrunken-headed females sister, although we still knew nothing of their lives, what they wore under their medieval habits, if their heads were shaved, or if they missed their real sisters. Now they shared an invisible husband who was also, inexplicably, their father.
Thank you. I see. I really enjoy your poems about these things that we all think about if we grow up this way, right?
Yeah, of course.
So much
of
fun.
Course.
So this is maybe an extension of that same topic. So if you can have some distance on us on this subject, but this is a little bit about that too. To what extent does the jump back in time and place express regret versus reflection? And that would be a very personal question. So
I am filled with regret. And I know it's pointless. Regret is of no use to anybody. And yet, of course, I'm filled with regret. Mostly regret that I was too young and foolish to respond to so many things I was given, to appreciate so much I was given. And even as an adult, how often I was self-absorbed and not able to respond to kindness or generosity or love, you know, any of that. Of course I'm filled with regret, and I refuse to let anyone talk me out of it, you know.
Yeah.
Therapists, you know, friends who say, oh, no, you should forgive yourself. No, I don't buy that. I mean, I grew up as a small child going to confession and examining my conscience, and even though there's a part of me that thinks that was a dreadful kind of education, it still left me with a sense of conscience, of knowing what is real sin and what isn't. What doesn't measure up to my own standards for myself? And I know how many times I failed to kind of respond to life, you know? So, of course, there's that regret. I regret that I was such a terrible child, that I tortured my parents, that I broke their hearts, that I left the church and, you know, made my mother cry, that I, you know, all the things I did. And yet, how could I not do that,
right,
in a sense?
You know, one thing that occurred to me when I was reading this collection, In Praise of Usefulness, you know, it just made me feel like these poems are, in a way, you know, you're doing it for yourself, you're writing out your thoughts, but they're also directed to other people.
Yes.
Whether or not the people will literally be able to read them.
Yeah.
These are reflections that you put out in the universe, and it's healing for everybody.
Yeah.
Right?
It's in a way it's an apology.
I suppose it's poetry.
The big sorry.
Yeah, the big sorry.
but it's also a kind of tribute to my parents,
yeah,
too,
absolutely.
Very much,
right,
and to that world. You just reminded me of a line that I love from one of my favorite poets, Theodore Retke, an American poet who died in the mid 60s, and he said, "We gain tenderness by long looking," and I love that line for many reasons. But I suppose tenderness or compassion, whatever you'd want to say, towards yourself, your younger self, but also towards your parents, towards that world,
right?
You know,
I think there's a poem in here, I'm not going to remember which one, about your mother, and she was a very talkative woman.
Yes.
And the poem, you know, frames this child's perspective or teenage perspective, perhaps, on mother's chattiness.
Yes.
And then there's this moment where she's very wise. And
I know the one you mean,
and
the
adult poet is reflecting on this and saying,
yeah,
look at that, she was very wise.
Yeah.
You know, for all of what I looked at as chatter back then, she was very...
Right, right.
And that struck me.
Well, I think in terms of writing memoir, you always have that double perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The person you were back then, and now the adult person making sense of it or trying to make sense of it.
Right.
So it's as if you have two points of view.
Both of which are so important. Because,
yeah,
of course, if that adult were to sit in the room with the talkative woman again,
yes,
you'd be rolling your eyes in 10 minutes.
Oh, I would.
Right.
And, you know, I remind myself of that because I'm like, oh, mommy, if only you were here, I'd be so nice, I'd be so good, I'd be so patient. And then I'd come off if you wouldn't, you know. But I'd like to think I would.
I'm very patient now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would never roll my eyes. I would never snap. I would never...
Right. And I want to clarify, I'm not just talking about you. I feel
of
this
course,
is how we
of
all
course.
Are.
Yeah, yeah.
So In your case, do you think leaving home helped your growth as a writer? I mean, it's very rich subject matter, and you definitely seemed to have wanted to leave, and yet, you know, there's all of this.
Oh, in many ways, I didn't. I mean, I was very conflicted about it.
Okay.
But then I was the difficult, ornery, troublesome kind of young woman who always wanted what I didn't have and never wanted what I actually got. So while I may have complained about Ireland and my family and my parents, when I had to leave, then I was heartbroken.
Right.
And when I left, I was homesick for years and complained bitterly about how much I missed everyone. And I have, this is a bit of a tangent, but I have a favorite New Yorker cartoon from many years ago that I keep on the wall of my office. And the scene is a bar, and there's an old fella drinking a pint in the bar, and there's a snake sitting beside him. And the snake has a very doleful expression, and the man says to him, "Oh, come off it. Getting kicked out of Ireland was the best thing that ever happened to you." So that cartoon really encapsulates something about my life. You know, I have a feeling I miss everyone as soon as they've gone, you know.
Right.
I'm trying not to do that with my current husband. Trying to appreciate him while he's here.
While he's here.
But, you know, again, I regret my foolishness. But, of course, you don't always know what you've got till it's gone either.
Right.
And I didn't really appreciate the loveliness of my childhood, the language, the voices, until they weren't there anymore. And
but it probably gives you so much more to write about.
It does.
Than if you had stayed in that little village.
That's possible.
Or you were in Dublin, so
yes.
The city.
It's possible, but
yeah.
Of course I'll never know.
Mm.
You know, sometimes I think my cousins, who were my best friends growing up, were far happier than I was. Mm. You know, they didn't leave. They were not constantly complaining about their lot. And yet, the other thing, of course, is it wasn't just leaving. I put myself through college here.
Yeah.
I met all kinds of people. It was very painful.
Right.
And I was talking to a student yesterday who's a German student in my class, and he's going to return to Germany next year after spending, I think it's 6 years in the United States.
Oh.
And we were talking about what a wonderful perspective that is and how lucky he feels to have spent time in both places, but that it's also difficult, and these are his words, to figure out where your home is.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I could really understand what he was saying.
Sure. Yeah.
Although we have very different experiences.
And the other thing is the language. So the Irish English and the
yes.
American English are so different, and yet you
yes.
can be understood going to a place.
Right.
But for
right.
a German, you know, there's also yeah. the language that you've learned.
Well, my sister emigrated to Germany,
oh.
and my other sister emigrated to Switzerland.
Right. Yes,
it's German speaking. So I can only imagine what they went through. But there's also an issue with speaking the same language, and yet it has different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Irish people are so aware of that.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of jokes on Facebook about what words mean in Ireland and what they mean here.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So language
yeah.
is huge.
Well, you just said something that took me a minute after you said
oh.
it. When you were talking about the New Yorker cartoon, you said there's an old fella at the bar.
An old fella, yeah.
And
yeah,
I
yeah,
realized
right.
it's old fellow, right?
Right, but in Ireland you'd say that old fella. Or
fella.
My old fella.
There's,
in fact, that's one of the biggest stumbling blocks for people, because Irish people, especially Dubliners, will say, "Your man or your woman." And Americans invariably go, "My man? No, it's a figure of speech. Your man over there, your woman, you know." And it's very hard for them to understand it.
Right,
so
right.
it's a way of talking. And the other part, of course, for me is that I gave up talking that way for a long time
yeah.
because I was self-conscious.
Yeah.
If people raise their eyebrows at every word you say, then if you're a shy person, you amend your speech
yeah,
after a while,
yeah.
you know. So
wonderful. I wonder if you could please read the title poem, In Praise of Usefulness,
certainly.
On page 29.
In Praise of Usefulness. The long spoon hammered from a single hunk of metal by my friend the blacksmith hangs from a hook on our kitchen wall. Testament to his friendship, which is solid too, and plain spoken, permanent. Nearby the bowl my neighbor culled from the red dirt of northern Vermont, his sure hands seducing curves from common clay. By the wood stove, the four-pronged metal fork my father fashioned to protect our hands and faces when we toasted bread at the open fire for tea. Mother loved the utility of kitchen gadgets, the tiny wires that sliced a hard-boiled egg into identical subdivisions, the plastic rain hat folded lengthwise like a map, whisked from her handbag to protect an ephemeral perm. The ingenuity of ordinary things delighted her, yet she underestimated usefulness as if it was only beauty's poor relation. If you can't be ornamental, then be useful, she instructed, not thinking how her words would twist my vision, shape my unfolding image of myself. But see this vessel, I want to tell her, this cup that holds my sacramental morning coffee, how it fits my palm, its roundness like a full belly, the dark blue of its glaze, the rough comfort of its lip.
Mm. Thank you so much.
My and poor mother, everything she said held up under a magnifying glass.
I loved it. I loved this one. I loved usefulness as beauty's poor relation.
That's indeed.
Such a great line.
Yeah.
So a couple questions. First, how did you come to write this one? I assume it has to do with your mother's reflections, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, often a poem will come from a phrase or a saying, like, if you can't be ornamental, be useful, which I well remember my mother saying. But a lot of this book came out of a sort of joke between me and my husband, Daniel, because if Daniel's about anything, it's about aesthetics and beauty. And I'm all about practicality. Mm-hmm. In fact, all of the pictures that you see on the wall here, the paintings, are his choices. And I complain that there's nothing in this room that's me, you know. In fact,
except the cup.
Well, the cup. If it was up to me, there'd be very little in this room, you know. I'm really a minimalist. And I'm also a neat freak. I love order. Mm-hmm. But I live with someone who doesn't care about that at all. And when we lived in the country, he grew flowers. I like vegetables and fruit. I like tools, you know. He likes, we have a series of bowls over there made by a friend of ours, David Scrace. He won't let me use them for salads. They're meant to be salad bowls, but they're too beautiful to use. So that's the kind of, you know, joke we have between us in
right.
terms of our temperaments. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in a practical world. I love useful things that are also beautiful, mm-hmm. but utilitarian things. And I always think of myself as being utilitarian, you know. You know, I have a great face for radio. a practical sort of person. Huh. And so it was fun to look at those things in my parents' life. My father was one of the hardest working people I've ever met, and he taught himself how to do everything around the house, how to fix everything. And he did electricity, he did plumbing, he did wallpapering and painting and mixing concrete and gardening too. But he also grew flowers and he played music. However, my parents were always working. And although I have to say, I grew up to be a lazy sod most of the time, you know. I was just daydreamy as a kid. But my brother was very responsible and hardworking. And I love all the things that my friends have made, and they're all over the house, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
So it was that impulse that made me come up with the name of the collection and also just ponder all of those practical things.
Now, I assume the poem was written before the name of the
yes,
collection
indeed
was decided.
It was. Yeah.
So, did you, as soon as you wrote that poem, realize this is the name of my next collection, or did you have to kind of look through and figure out which one?
Oh,
most?
Yes, not at all. Though I found myself talking about objects and useful things in so many poems that it became a kind of theme.
And once you saw that, it
yeah.
made so much sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to admit, after the book was published, I went up to a local store and bought that orangey-colored vase on the end of the row there, and it was a completely useless item. And I rejoiced. I must admit it was on sale.
But you're, like, growing.
Useless.
You're growing.
I don't want to be useful anymore. I want to be useless and do useless things.
Oh, funny.
So there's an Elvis Costello collection called All This Useless,
All This
Beauty,
Useless Beauty. I love
which
that.
I love. So I've been contemplating
what shall
those
we
things.
Do? What shall we do with all this useless
yes,
beauty?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a funny kind of theme for me.
Yeah.
But no, of course, I didn't even think of a collection until I had a large number of poems.
Sure.
And then it did begin to be a theme. And the cup nailed it, of course.
I did want to ask you about titles.
Yes.
Because I love that title of that poem and of the collection. And I just wondered, how do you go about, if there's any sort of manner in which you often will find yourself figuring out titles for poems, do they jump out at you, or is it hard for you sometimes?
I don't think I'm very good at titles. Often my titles are just one word, you know. Mm. But occasionally I'll hit on something that entertains me or amuses me or seems to fill the bill. But I don't think I'm one of those people who's terribly good at it. And Billy Collins has some great titles. And actually Daniel has great titles. I don't think that's one of my specialties. But also, I almost never title a poem until after I've finished writing.
Okay.
You know? And then there are a few in there that amuse me, right. Like One Size Fits All came about after the fact, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed doing that. And the one about being in the spa, what was it now? How a day at the spa reminds me of the asylum at
Saint-Rémy.
That definitely came out of the notion of wandering around in these bathrobes like lunatics. And, you know, so it was fun. I mean, sometimes it's just part of my humor to come up with a title
right.
like that. But, of course, titles are vitally important. When you pick up a book, you know, you flick through it. You don't start at the beginning of a book of poetry and go through. You look at the titles. And you do the same with a book of essays and a fictional novel, too.
Yeah.
Titles are huge. Like, yeah. First lines are really important.
And then some of your titles are just telling what the poem's going to be about, visiting an aunt
yes.
who is losing her memory.
Yes.
Right.
Well, that's another thing that I learned from Ted Kooser, the Nebraska poet Ted Kooser. He has a whole piece in his book about writing poetry about how the title can do a lot of the work for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to explain it in the poem.
Right.
It can.
Which is so often the complaint of people who don't read a lot of poetry. They
yes.
feel like it's really hard to fathom what the poem's about.
Yeah, but it can save you time,
yeah.
you know. So I don't have to explain that it's about an aunt who is losing her memory. I can just give that as the title and then read the poem,
yes.
you know.
So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about poetic influence. I don't mean the influence of other poets,
mm-hmm.
but more like we've talked about your own life in the Catholic Church, world history, myth, feminism, you know, all of these things. Do you find yourself, other than the Catholic Church and your own life, do you find yourself reaching to a certain influence or inspiration more than others?
Ah, that's interesting. Well, I grew up with the English poets, you know, the Lake poets, and Gerard Manley Hopkins, mm. and, you know, Wordsworth, all of those people who had a huge influence, because I was reading poetry with my brother when I was 16, and we were fascinated by poetry. And I was also reading the kind of the beat poets, the Liverpool beat poets, rather than the American ones. And so there was all of that pop music, folk music, rock and roll, all of those things combined with poetry. It was a great time.
Mm.
And just taking all of that in. But as you know, I have a good memory, and I have a lot of poems in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I can memorize very easily. And I love to replay poems and recite them. And so I tend, of course, to memorize rhyming poems, but also savor the words, the language. So that's a big influence. But my former husband, who I'm very good friends with, his father is a poet and was an English professor. And
Was he at Bates?
No, at Lewisburg, Bucknell.
Okay.
He's retired now. Yes. He fed me a lot of poems when I was a young and foolish. And he also read his poetry to us in the family whenever we got together. But he's the one who turned me on to Theodore Rettke and
okay.
gave me a book of his poems. And so he was a big influence. And, you know, my former teacher, EVM Margaret Edwards, was a big influence too. But I just read a lot.
Yeah.
And I still have a great fondness for the English poets,
right,
and
right.
for Shakespeare's sonnets, which I love. And so you know, in recent times, I love Billy Collins. I love his humor and his lightness. Mm-hmm. But there are so many poets out there.
Yeah.
And I still value the fact that I grew up with the more traditional English poets, and it isn't just all contemporary.
Right.
Because I have to admit, in the MFA program I attended, there was no focus on the tradition.
Okay.
The focus was all contemporary poets.
Isn't that interesting?
And I think that's unfortunate.
Is that because of a lack of time?
Probably.
Yeah.
But also because everyone is interested in the contemporary poets, and I just think we have a lot to learn from the tradition, the canon,
right,
even though, of course, that may be out of fashion these days.
Well, and there may be an assumption, too, that the MFA students already did an undergraduate degree that covered the classics, but that's not always
true. I doubt that very much in my experience.
Yeah,
you know.
Let's talk about the cover of this book, which people can't see, but we can describe it and just talk about how this cover came to be. It's beautiful. Do you want to?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to think about how the cover came about. Of course, it came about with this mug that's on the front. It's a little blue ceramic mug, and I drink my coffee out of it every morning. I bought it, I can't think how many years ago, at a craft fair at Shelburne Museum. And oddly enough, to my amazement and delight, last year I went to a craft fair and found the man who made the mug. And told him about my book. In fact, I gave him a copy. And I was so excited to have found him because there I recognized the cups that he was making.
Right.
And he said, oh, that's one of my old cups. I'm making different ones now. So it was a great discovery. But I've always loved that cup because it fits my hand. It's small.
Which you say in that poem.
And I like small mugs. And also because I like to drink very hot, very black coffee. And it goes cold in a big mug, you know. There's a practical reason here. But it was also the editor, Lynn Stone, who took the mug away with her and said, I have to take it. It has to be on the cover. And so she took it and put it on her counter and waited until the light was just right to photograph the mug. But I also was inspired by a little print I have upstairs, I've had for years, by David Hockney, is a plant with light slanting through the window and illuminating it. And I love that little image. And so I talked to the designer about that. And while we weren't imitating the image, it was something about the slanting light coming in from one side.
Right, right.
But actually, when the book first came out, it had a sort of pinkish cover, rather more an orangey sunset cover. And I was very disappointed because it was that bright yellow that I wanted.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They very kindly reprinted it. And now I love it.
Yeah.
I love the bright yellow.
So it was a problem at the printer and not a problem with the design.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And some people like the other color, but for me, this one really pops.
Yeah, this is great.
And also because since we moved into town, we lived in a dark log cabin before. Now we live in a bright place. And I feel as if I want more light in my life. So
right.
It's symbolic in that way, too.
Right, right. What are you reading these days?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I went to see Salman Rushdie at UVM.
Oh, how was that?
Just inspired. I thought he was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
And he particularly appealed to me because what he talked about was stories.
Oh, yeah.
And the origins of stories. And so I purchased his book, which is over on the coffee table there, his children's book.
Right.
And it's called The Sea of Stories.
Yes.
And I just love it. It was intended as a children's book, but the language is marvelous.
Mm.
And Daniel and I have been reading it aloud to each other. I bought it actually to read to my grandson, who's 8 years old.
Wonderful.
But I've been enjoying it myself.
I think you told me that you and Daniel, did you read Harry Potter to each other?
We've read all kinds
You've
of books
read all
to each other.
You read to each other.
Yeah.
While you cook.
Well, I used to. He hasn't done that for a while because after having a cold for a month, he lost his voice. But now it's back again. So we're back to reading. I'm very happy to say. I'm not back to cooking, but we're back to reading.
Well, you don't have your hand right now.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't.
Speaking of in praise of usefulness, we should mention that you have broken your wrist.
Yes, I broke my wrist, which was very traumatic, but it's also inspired several new poems.
There you go.
Because it became a metaphor. I couldn't help it. And the first thing was that I had it in my arm in a sling, and then I started to think about many, many years ago how I carried my son in a sling when he was a baby, and it happened to be the same color as the sling that I was using. So that became a kind of metaphor. Now I'm carrying my own arm rather than this infant. And then, you know, the metaphors just kept growing.
Yeah.
And one of my latest obsessions is poems about birds. And everybody's written a poem about birds. And at first I thought, oh, why would I want to do that? Everyone else is doing it. But it has been a really rich place to go.
Yeah.
That's not like my Irish memoir material. Although I have to admit I'm fascinated by the names of birds in Irish as well.
Oh.
And the folklore around birds.
Yeah.
I began thinking about a broken wing, you know. And also that I have a little metal plate in my arm now with screws.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, I have a little door in there. So I began to get a little batty. Perhaps it was the painkillers. But
painkillers make for good poetry.
Oh,
you're
do.
Not the first
they
to
do.
Discover.
But I began to have these associations based on having, and perhaps it has to do with my right arm, since I'm a right-handed person, I began having to use my left hand to type.
Yeah.
And that seemed to switch something in my mind. And in fact, I started writing more,
wow.
oddly enough. So God forbid I should break another bone, but it has been interesting.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
So my last question for you is, do you have any advice for the prose writer who is attempting poetry or the poet who is attempting prose? And I suppose that by implication, I mean for the first time.
Ah, okay. So again, I think going back to what we said earlier, I think it's about blending the two,
mm-hmm.
not seeing them as opposites.
Separate.
But they're different, different genres, but they speak to each other.
Right.
So perhaps allowing one's prose to be more poetic, allowing in some similes and metaphors and imagery
mm-hmm.
can, I think, really expand prose. And also paying the same attention to language, to choice of words that you might pay in a poem. But equally, I'm fond of narrative poetry. It doesn't have to be a story,
mm-hmm.
but it also doesn't have to be obscure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for example, Billy Collins takes us off on these little trips in his poem, you know, and we don't know where we're going to end up at the end of a poem, but we're never lost either. And I like that about him.
Yeah.
And again, often for me, something will begin with a phrase or a word that I'm interested in or some little image from the past, and allowing that to be a beginning, to make associations with it, I think can work for either poetry or creative nonfiction.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, memoir is even closer. But there's so many different kinds of creative nonfiction, too.
Right, right.
And it very much depends on one's own style and one's own voice.
Okay.
Great.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Angela.
Thank you. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Repeat the name of the book, In Praise of Usefulness, Poetry by Angela Patton. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the poet Angela Patton. You can learn more about her work at the website she shares with her husband, local poet Daniel Lusk, carrigbin.com, and I have no idea if I'm saying that right. It's CarrigBinn. Given that Angela Patton's new poetry collection concerns birds and their meaning in our lives, today's Write the Book prompt is to observe the birds as they come back to our attention with the advent of spring and write them into your work. Good luck with your work in the coming week and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. For all of you who are trying to write these days, be sure to check the archives of Write the Book because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.